welcome in the latest episode of that SEC podcast. I'm your host, Michael Breton. Go by SEC Mike. Go on the Twitters, and there he is, our great friend, back again, Stephen Lassen, senior editor over at Athlon Sports. Stephen, how are you?
Hey, Mike. It's good to talk to you, my friend. What a, kind of crazy offseason we find ourselves in. More news of college football. The world of college football never stops. So I don't know about you, but I'm just excited we get to talk some college football tonight. It's been, like I said, kind of a crazy offseason. Always good to keep the news flowing around the SEC, right?
Yeah, absolutely. So, and I think it's just going to get ratcheted up here with spring football. We've already got, it's already begun in some SEC campuses this week, a lot more. And before you know it, Stephen, all 16 teams will be in spring practice. So we're going to have a lot to discuss over the next weeks. And yes, there is basketball on, but not for Stephen Lassen, who's working hard. Can you give us an update on the Athlon Sports College Football Preview magazine and all the work you're doing to get that in yet again?
Absolutely. I think the best way to describe it is all of like the small pieces that you see in the magazine with all the coaching information, the stat boxes and things like that. We're compiling those. We're debating who's going to be on the covers. I am also just in the midst of trying to compile every returning starter for all 138 teams now. We'll see you, Sacramento State and North Dakota State. So all that background stuff, Mike, I'm just trying to compile as much data as I can too for like all conference teams, predictions and stuff. So we got a little bit of time before we have to start wading into that, which is good because I'm eager to see what's going on at some of these spring practices, like you mentioned.
Well, before we get into that, and again, Stephen came up with another great topic for this show, a reason for optimism for each and every SEC team heading into spring. But I'm a little optimistic, or at least I was, Stephen, when I saw this photo. I thought it was real. Can you confirm or deny that you are considering growing a mustache?
That's like me after like week production, right? I don't have time to do anything else other than just like figure out where all these transfers are going, evaluating the transfers. So yeah, that's probably going to be me come like May 5th or 6th after production wraps up or so, right?
I think it's a good look for you. I'm just saying.
I heard that guy has like Arch Manning like 8th in his quarterback rankings or some crazy thing like that.
No, I kid.
That's
but
good.
Seriously, yeah, and shout out Liquid. I believe Liquid, he made that one, so you can credit him. Well, big fan of the show. He wants to give us mustaches, so I appreciate you, Liquid Buddy. But all right, before we get into it, Stephen, there are two things I wanted to ask you real quick. We had some relatively big news here in the SEC because former Kentucky head coach Mark Stoops has been added to the Texas coaching staff. So that's interesting. What are your thoughts? And I had forgotten, Stephen, all about it, but for about 12 hours, Mark Stoops was A&M coach. So, there's some bad blood down. He must really hate A&M. You know what?
I was just thinking about that after I saw that hire. It's like Mark Stoops finally gets the job in Texas, right? But it's not the job in Texas that he wanted. I actually like this for Texas. And I think anytime you can add like brain trust, guys who are former coaches, guys who were pretty good on one side of the ball. Now, I think it's fair to wonder if maybe Stoops lost his fastball those last couple of years. But as far as being an off-the-field analyst, the guy with that much experience in the SEC and on defense through over these years, I think it's a pretty valuable addition. I just like on those off-the-field analyst-type roles, as many former coaches, coordinators you can have, especially with every team building those up, it does not hurt to have more brain trust on that side of the ball. So for all the jokes we can make about Mark Stoops finally getting to Texas, I actually think it's a nice move for Steve Sarkisian.
Do you think Sarkisian will pick his brain on how to improve the red zone offense after Stoops, what was it, QB sneak twice right in a row? That if he would have handed it to his running back, Kentucky probably would have beat Texas. But I don't know. What if Stoops gets his hands on that red zone offense?
Mike, I'd be a little bit worried. I mean, Texas has had some red zone issues already the last couple of years, right? Maybe that was the first question in the job interview is, Mark, what were you thinking on that red zone sequence at the end of the game? Because that was explain yourself, because that made no sense at all. So no, I would not let Mark Stoops anywhere near my offensive game plan. I would probably put him in charge of like defensive scouting or something like that.
Right. And correct me if I'm wrong, Stephen, but I know there are Stoops connections to Oklahoma. It's kind of interesting. Texas here. Now, Mark Stoops and Kirby Smart are pretty close. So I can't imagine Sarkisian went to, hey, Kirby, who should I add here? But I don't know. It's just interesting. You get Muschamp, of course. Now you got Stoops, two guys both close to Kirby. Are we just trying to get Kirby defense, Sarkisian offense to create a monster of an SEC program down here or something?
What's the saying? You can't beat them, so you join them, right? So Texas can't get past Georgia with the way these last couple of meetings have played out. So why not go pick off of the Kirby Smart and Georgia coaching tree? And frankly, I mean, it's not a bad idea. Georgia's and Ohio State and now Indiana kind of set the standard for college football. So considering the success that Georgia's had, go get somebody off that defensive tree, go hire some assistants who can help implement that strategy and scheme. It's not a bad place to start, Mike. I think Texas defense has been pretty good, but I think the hope of all this of like getting Muschamp and some of these other guys has got to be, it's like, it's been good, but now it's got to be elite. And that's how you try to get over the hump and go from semifinals to national champion. And I think it's going to help Texas. We'll see if they can get over the hump and beat Georgia and win the national championship this year.
Any surprise that it is Texas, though? Because given that connection of Kirby, if you were to tell me Mark Stoops was going to join a staff, I would have thought it would have been Georgia.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a good point. It's always interesting. I guess the question I would have with a lot of these former coaches is, you know, is what's the role that you're going to step into? Because like some of these guys are just going to be like head scouts, and like they are like the off-field head coach of the defensive scouting department there, and they scout, or they are the offensive scouting, basically a defensive mind that's self-scouting the team's offense and some of the other offenses to help them game plan. So I guess maybe the role could be bigger at Texas. That would be my only thought, is maybe as to why he would pick that, or maybe just to go, you know, hook up again with Muschamp and some of those guys that he's been with in the SEC. So that's a good question, Mike. I don't know if I have a great answer on that one.
Well, I certainly know you're all in on Texas. Been for about 48 months, I feel like. But you're all in. You know, we got Arch back. We're going to win it all, which I may very well do it. But if I may, Stephen, be negative here for just, I've never been negative when it comes to Texas. We all know that. But if things go sideways, could this be interim head coach Mark Stoops?
I mean, it could be. It's a possibility, right? He's in the building. You wouldn't have to shuffle the staff significantly. He just comes in and he's the new head coach for an interim basis. I think that's a long shot, Mike. I'd be surprised if Mark Stoops is a head coach again, especially in the state of Texas this year or even in the future years. Perhaps maybe he ends up at like a G5 school somewhere in the SEC, but I think it's a long shot. But I see where you're going with that one, though. Will Muschamp too? I mean, like, think of the sideline tantrums that we're going to get this year from Muschamp.
All right. Well, hey, speaking of a tantrum, I saw a lot of fans have a tantrum here, Stephen, because Josh Heupel, I'm surprised this is, you know, people are reacting in this manner, but Josh Heupel is out here supporting a 24-team playoff. I think all these coaches would support a 24-team playoff. That's why I don't think it's a Heupel thing. I think it's all these damn coaches know, hey, they get judged on getting into the playoff. We got 9-game SEC, and there's a good reason. We don't leave this stuff up to the coaches, but if we did, I think if they got their way, we would have a 24-team playoff. Do you agree with that? And any reaction to Josh Heupel given his support for a 24-team playoff?
Mike, I think you're absolutely right. I think if every coach probably had their way, there probably would be a larger playoff right now. And I think some of that is it's become all about the playoff, right? I mean, it's like every season is defined by either making the playoff now, or in some cases, it's got to be national championship or bust. And I don't necessarily subscribe to that theory, because I do think there are a lot of teams whose success level isn't determined by just making the playoff. Like Vanderbilt, the season that they had last year, it's a pretty successful season, even though they fell short. You think about where Mississippi State has been, like their goals should be different than a Georgia or Texas coming into this year. So I always think about like each tier of college football has its own goals. But I think the 2014 playoff, if we're worried about watering down the regular season, to me, this is going to water it down even more. Because, I mean, we talked like after Ohio State and Texas. Okay, Texas lost the first game, but they've got a chance to get back in it. And you could kind of see each week they got back in it. They had the second loss. And, of course, they lost to Georgia. You know, you start taking those games away and it's like, oh, okay, Texas lost to Ohio State. No big deal, because we got a 2014 playoff. They're going to get in, right? So I just think from a watering down the regular season, we should absolutely be worried about what happens in a 2014 playoff. Now, what I worry about is it's become all about the playoff, and that we're going to get to a point to where 16 isn't enough. It's going to be 24 because teams miss it. This year it was, you know, the Texas, the Vanderbilt. The year before was Alabama. It's going to be somebody else in the future. The calls to expand, to have more teams in is going to get louder because it's been made about the playoffs. So I personally do not support a 2014 playoff, but I know why the coach is doing that's because they are judged on making the playoff now in college football.
I can see it now, Steven. A 7-5, let's say Oklahoma. Well, we lost to 5 of the top 20. We belong in the 24, you know, like that's where we're going.
Mike, I don't know if you've seen the proposals from Tony Petitti, the Big Ten commissioner, but he wants to turn like later in the season into like a play-in sort of situation, which on the surface isn't necessarily like a bad idea. But like, if you kind of game this out and you step back and also see, why does the Big Ten want an expanded playoff? Well, first of all, just from like a program hierarchy, the SEC's kind of outflanked them, like just in terms of which programs are better if you just kind of threw out records and you just wanted to start over at a new program. Their TV partners don't have playoff games. That's why they want an expanded playoff. That's why they want to get CBS. They want to get Fox. They want to get NBC. There's no gray area there. But, you know, in a sense of like play-in games, I mean, Mike, think about a 7-4 like Rutgers team playing like an 8-4 or 8-3 Iowa team for a playoff. I mean, Nick Saban said it best. Is that what we want football to be? I mean, no, we should not be. Suddenly these play-in games are just ridiculous. If we're going to expand to 16 or even more, to me, it's got to be the best teams in college football and get away from this play-in game nonsense and everything else.
Yeah, shout out Michael Dunlap. I think he nailed it here. College football's going to hell in a handbasket. I wouldn't go quite that far, but if we do expand and do all this nonsense, I'm not. He's dead on. You know what?
It's funny how everything in the world of college football is in chaos. But like the Saturdays, I forget that everything is going on, and I'm like, oh man, that game is amazing. I can't wait to watch this game next week. And then in the week, I'm like, oh my gosh, like there's all these things happening. I mean, they're still kicking around the idea of expanding the playoff. Like after the vote didn't go through to go from 12 to 16, maybe it's back on the table. And I mean, it feels like every year we're going to go through this and go through the transfer cycle. So, Mike, I just hope at some point we get some kind of like calm waters in the sport where we're not debating the same things over and over again. I mean, do you agree with me 24 teams would be a mistake?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, we haven't even had enough of the 12 team.
Yeah.
I don't understand the logic in it advancing and then it immediately thereafter wanting to expand the playoff without seeing how the 12-team model plays out. And I would say for the most part, the 12-team has been good. Although I wasn't crazy about Ohio State losing their last regular season game and then getting to still compete. No, and they weren't the first to ever do that. So, but I think they earned the title. And then last year they fixed it with the seeding for the most part. But I still think that I hate it for you, Summerall. But getting Tulane and JMU with the I mean that was nonsense. But I think if they would just do away with that, I think 12 is perfect.
I agree with you. Like we've had 2 years of the 12-team playoff. Like we don't have enough data to know a lot of these things. And I think every time a year happens, there's an overreaction of, well, we got to change this or change that. And sometimes it's like, hey, this year just might be an outlier. And so I think let's get a couple years of data on the 12-team playoff to figure it out. I will underscore, and I know I continue to say this, and I feel like I'm going to be a broken record every time you ask about the playoff. There absolutely has to be more transparency around the playoff. I mean, how could you have any confidence in their ability to rank teams when they say, oh, well, Notre Dame and Miami are now on the screen and the same, and they're side by side, and I commanded the committee to go back and watch the games. Like, what are we doing here? If you need those kind of things to rank teams, I'm not sure you should be involved in the playoff committee. So I would like to see us get to a point where we have more transparency. Let's post the metrics. Post the metrics out there, and that way we can all see them. The sports, I can forget the name of the company that does them all for the playoff committee. They have tons of great intel. It should be public. That way you, the fans, and we, the media, can talk about it, and we can see where these teams are ranked and debate them more appropriately. So I think we need more transparency, and we probably need smarter football people on the committee, however that looks. I know I'm ranting at this point, but I've continued to be very frustrated at the playoff committee and the lack of common sense sometimes that follows these things.
Wait a second. You don't think Hunter Yurachek's qualified to be on the committee?
6'7"?
Get his ass out of here.
Mike, no athletic director really has the time to be on the playoff committee, right? They're so busy with everything else. Do they really have time to study the differences between Navy and Tulane and James Madison for one of those G5 spots? No, they don't. I don't understand what we're doing here. It's crazy.
All right. Well, I think I know why you said what you said, Stephen. You had to get out some negativity because you promised you were going to be optimistic, but you had to get a little bit of negativity out. So let's switch gears because we're going to hit on all 16 SEC teams. A reason for optimism for each and every one of them heading into spring football. And how about, Stephen, we start with some of the teams that kind of get dismissed a little bit on the other shows. So let's start with Arkansas. New coach, Ryan Silverfield. Excuse me, Silver Fox. I always screw that up. He had a pretty good overall record at Memphis. He actually beat Arkansas last year. He's beaten Mississippi State. He's slain some SEC teams. What are you most optimistic about the Arkansas Razorbacks heading into their first spring under old Ryan Silver Fox?
Mike, I think the biggest reason for optimism has to be, and this is kind of basic, but I think a fresh start is a good thing here. I think Sam Pittman did a lot of good things. You know, they had the 9-win season. They went to a couple bowl games, but it kind of felt like things were getting stale. And I think in this era of college football with NIL and transfer portal, like, hope and optimism sell more than anything. Because if you have the hope, you have the optimism, it converts into donations, which converts into being able to get good players. So I think a coach that has had a track record of being pretty successful at rebuilding the roster through the portal and a fresh start overall, and a guy that maybe certainly has questions about nationally, there's some skepticism. I think certainly there is there's some motivation there. It should be on the motivation of Arkansas after going 2-10 and Silverfield to pull to prove people wrong. So in the most basic sense, I think just a fresh start with a revamped roster. You've got KJ Jackson, you got Quincy Rhodes, like those are two of your building blocks. But after what kind of the way last year played out, I just think Arkansas needed a fresh start. So that is kind of my biggest reason for Arkansas, is just getting something new after such a disappointing year last year.
Yeah, I think that's fair. And I do think it's also fair to say, as soon as he stepped on campus, he's done a really good job retaining key players, attacking the transfer portal, high school recruiting. You know, I don't know if you have seen, and I don't even know if this is valid, so grain of salt here, but there was the local Arkansas high school quarterback that was, I believe he was going into his senior year of high school, and they got him to come into college a year early, apparently making $1 million to be on the roster. That I'm not really a big fan of, because again, if he's coming in here and you're getting him out of the portal and you plan to start, that's a different story, but that's one thing. Now again, maybe this kid is ready to play and he's gonna look awesome in spring, or I don't even know if he's on campus yet, but that to me I'm not a huge fan of, because you're not guaranteed anything. We don't even know if he's gonna be on the roster next season. Could there be, does that concern you at all?
I guess the question would be, and I guess there's a larger point here of, that's kind of, is that pretty much the game in college football right now? I also think there is a kind of like a standard that sort of gets set in a quarterback room, or really any room. I mean, you know, you have the guy who is the leader, you kind of expect him to be the most highly paid, you know, quarterback. But if you're, depending on how that hierarchy works out, like KJ Jackson, AJ Hill, anybody else, you know, I would think I would probably assume that they're going to pay KJ Jackson pretty well next year, given that, you know, he was the guy, one of the guys at Silverfield's press conference and also one of the building blocks this year. So I think in general, Mike, I think Arkansas, and especially we saw this with Hunter Yurecek at the end of last season, talking about, you know, the investments in the program and stuff. And I think this is where maybe Ryan Silverfield can actually be really good at, is that I do think he can be very a very likable guy, to where he can go to these places and he can speak and he can draw in some checks and maybe some boosters who weren't in on the past. So maybe you are going to go through that rocky period of, okay, we got to get our NIL and our structure together. But once you have that, you got a guy who can maybe sell it. So maybe there is some playing the game kind of going on here. But also, I think in general, I think waking up the NIL structure and getting those donations is a goal, has to be a priority for Silverfield.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, just the fact that they, again, allegedly they're paying him that much, but whatever they're paying him, you know, it does speak to the fact that they have resources to pay probably a third string quarterback quite a bit of money. And if he does stay, and if he is elite, at least, you know, potentially elite, you know, that could be the difference between Arkansas making a nice little run here under Silverfield. Probably not next year, but year two, year three, if they have an elite quarterback, that's what you, because they're likely will be at a talent disadvantage overall when it comes to the SEC. That's just kind of the reality, but you could close that gap if you have a special talent at quarterback.
Also, I think a quarterback is a good selling point for your transfer portal. Because if you have a good quarterback, receivers, running backs, offensive linemen often want to come and play. Of course, the money helps with that too. So, yeah, I think it's a little different than the NFL and kind of like finding that centerpiece of your quarterback, your franchise quarterback, to go with your new head coach. You get that new era, but there is definitely still a part of that in college football where, okay, if you could find your answer for the next 3 years, you get this thing going, all that NIL starts to pick up and you can kind of keep it going beyond one quarterback. So I like, anytime you can add talented quarterbacks on the roster with upside, I love it. Long term, I think that, you know, Silverfield, I think, is in a bit of a, or short term, I think he's in a tough spot because of the roster overhaul, the record last year. But I think long term, if they can make some inroads there, I think there's a chance that maybe Silverfield proves some people wrong on his hire.
And Razorback Pride says his dad's on staff, he's not going anywhere. Steven, does that remind you of any other Arkansas quarterbacks with the dad was on staff?
Well, sort of, yeah. I almost said Chad and Chandler Morris over there.
Bingo, that's exactly what
I didn't want to bring it up because we talked about optimism at Arkansas, and I was like, oh man, here we go with Chad Morris again. So yeah, we had to do it though.
All right, I apologize. We're being optimistic. So newness, I think that is good for Arkansas. And just, I don't know, just some semblance of a defense would be nice. You know what?
Yeah, don't you have confidence in Ron Roberts to at least make a difference there?
I think so. He's experienced in this conference. He's going to this 3-3-5. You know, he's kind of the godfather of it. You know, at Ole Miss, they're running it now. Now they're running it at Tennessee. They're running it all over college football. It's kind of taken over. Yeah, it's got to be better than we've seen the last couple of years.
I would say Roberts is a massive upgrade over the interim coordinator they had last year. I do worry a bit about how, like, there's only probably only so much the coordinator can get out of the personnel, you know, with all the transfers and everything else coming in. But I mean, again, they were so bad on that side of the ball last year that probably a fresh start with all the personnel probably isn't the worst thing.
Mm-hmm. All right, let's go next, Stephen, to Mississippi State. What are you optimistic about for Jeff Lebby's program in year three? They took a nice step up last year, made a bowl game. Did they deserve to go? Oh, yeah. I'm sorry. We're being optimistic. They sure as hell deserve to go, Stephen. But they took a step up. Why are they going to take another step up year three?
Mike, I think the obvious answer here is Kamario Taylor. But I'm going to go a little different. I want to go with Zach Arnett taking over as defensive coordinator. Because Coleman Hutzler's defenses, boy, 38 and 39 points a game allowed in the SEC the last 2 years. It just feels like this is a much more serious and a much more legitimate SEC defensive coordinator. So I think we know that Jeff Lebby can put some points on the board, like what we saw out of Kamario Taylor last year. I think he's due for a breakout year. But if I'm looking for optimism here, I'm looking at it as Lebby's going to score points, but you got to get stops on defense to take that next step to get to 6-7 wins, even though it's going to be tougher in the 9-game slate. So the personnel has improved on defense through the portal the last couple of years. Now it feels like they got a coordinator who can actually get more out of that. So I think Zach Arnett's return is the reason I'm the most optimistic for Mississippi State this year.
No, I think that's fair. He's been here before, obviously, and he's had tremendous success as the defensive coordinator, which is the role we're asking him to be, not a head coach. He's another one that runs this unique, I don't know if it's quite a 3-3-5. Yeah, I think it is a 3-3-5. Again, all these coaches are going to it, so they must see me having success switching it up. And of course, it's only going to be a matter of time, Stephen, where these offenses figure out the 3-3-5. They're probably just going to go straight Philadelphia Eagles ground and pound, and no one will be able to stop them anymore, and then we'll have to change something else. But, yeah, for the time being, yeah, I mean, just a – man, if we just had a semblance of defense, I hate to repeat myself with Arkansas here, but if Mississippi State was just capable on that side of the football with what they've showcased on offense, I mean, they're getting guys either in the NFL or, hate to say it, like big-time money in the portal. Yeah. But they are developing tons of players on the offensive side of the football under Jeff Lebby. I think if they start winning some games, they can afford to pay some of these players to stay.
Absolutely. And I think in the most basic sense, Mike, it's like you've got maybe a superstar, rising star, a quarterback, and that side of the ball is going to be set with Lebby and Taylor. And I think you kind of trust Lebby to say, okay, if you can fill a need in the portal at receiver, they, you know, Fluff Bothwell coming back too, they got to figure out the offensive line. But if you're not giving up 38 points a game in SEC play and you're giving up like 10, 11 fewer points a game, all of a sudden, you know, some of those toss-up games that we talked about with Texas, with Tennessee, with Florida last year, some of those could easily flip into W. So it is going to get harder with 9 games. But at the same time, it feels like they now have a complement, whereas it felt like last year you knew the offense was going to score, but the defense was so bad. Now it feels like maybe there's more balance, or maybe there's more, it's an equal kind of battle there. Like, you got a good defense to go with a good offense, and that could help maybe some of the growing pains that you may see offensively from a young quarterback too.
Mm-hmm. All right, how about Kentucky, Stephen? Year one under Will Stein, totally rebuilt roster, coaching staff, obviously. What are you most optimistic about when it comes to the Kentucky Wildcats?
Mike, this is, I think, a pretty easy one. I think it's just a new era and also a different direction. Mark Stoops was a defensive guy. Will Stein is an offensive guy. Pretty clear that he wanted this job, of how fast it took from job opening to Will Stein taking the job. Track record of success on offense. I mean, UTSA, Oregon, successful offenses, developing quarterbacks. Think you got to like that pairing if you're Kentucky, and of course his ties to the state as well. But I think much like Arkansas, I think things were really stale at Kentucky. So now you've got a younger coach coming in. He's going to try and score some points after every game under Mark Stoops felt like if you could win 17-13, that was the goal. So I think you trust Stein offensively. You trust that he can get the most out of Kenny Minchie. The portal class was very good offensively. They've got a long way to go on offense, but that's what's selling right now in college football is high-powered offenses. So new direction, new start, a coach with success on offense, and I think that could translate into some good things for Kentucky in 26 and beyond that.
Hmm. Well, I know you promised optimism, Stephen, but I made no such vow, so... Again, not to be overly negative here, but because I've made my feelings well known on Kentucky this offseason. Are you surprised at all how many pundits and whatnot? I don't know if that's what we are. Any commentators have kind of come out and
right?
Yeah. And just been so like over the moon on Kentucky and Will Stein. And again, I want them to be optimistic. Apathy is horrible. You know, being a bottom tier team is horrible. I don't wish that on anyone. But I mean, I have seen multiple people that I respect in this business say, "Man, I think they're building a playoff pro." And I'm like, "What?
Yeah.
Are you surprised that people are going that far with it?"
Yes, very much so. I think I've read similar things to you, and I almost, when I read that, I'm almost going, am I missing something? Because it feels like a good season would be like 7-5, 6-6, just getting to a bowl game. It feels, I mean, I guess we shouldn't rule anything out just considering Indiana just won the national championship and you see some of these other programs taking big steps. But it seems like a pretty big leap for this program to go from where it was last year to just top 25. Now, if you want to sell me on like a 3-year plan, I'm all ears. I think 2026 is going to be pretty tough. And we assume Kenny Minchie is going to be pretty good. I think he could be, but there's also the risk that he doesn't work out and they're struggling to score 17 points a game again.
Yeah, I'm just kind of surprised that everybody's so over the moon. Now, if they, like you said, if they win 7 games this year, I think that's completely fair, and he will deserve his flowers, Will Stein and company. But I don't know. I need to see something before I'm just kind of all in with enthusiasm.
Do you think some of that could be just everybody looking for the next Indiana? Everybody looking for the next like Texas Tech every year, trying to figure out what, like throw a dart and say maybe that one hits.
I think maybe I had not really quite considered that, but yes, everybody is looking for the next Indiana. I don't know what Kentucky has to do with that other than premier basketball program that
they border, you know, each other.
But it's not as if Will Stein, you know, dominated lower level football and he's bringing a bunch of guys. You know what I mean? Like, but I get your point. Like, I think Nick Roush has said it well. I like having him on. I think he knows his stuff. But basically, his point that he's made on this show, Stephen, is Kentucky, they kind of got to be a year ahead when it comes to projecting a coach. Like, had they gotten John Sumrall when they could have, they'd probably be looking pretty, you know? But once he starts having some success... Well, he already had success, but even more success, it's like, well, you want to go to Kentucky or would you rather go to Auburn or Florida? And he essentially had his two picks, and obviously he made them. So that's not to say that Will Stein's bad by any means, but we don't know. Kentucky almost has to evaluate that in advance. Does that make sense?
It makes total sense, because I think if you're Kentucky and you think that he's your guy and you say, let's wait till after 2026, Dante Moore is coming back to Oregon. There is a chance that Oregon wins the national championship. So for one, he wouldn't be necessarily available until late January. Or two, what other jobs could come open? Could be Florida State. It could be a whole host of jobs that are higher up on the tier. So I think, yeah, I think you have to be ahead, but you also have to not be afraid to do something different, because what was working was getting stale. And in this environment, offense, up and coming head coaches on that side of the ball are the ones that most people are kind of gravitating to. So I think that makes total sense. Like for Kentucky, it's always a risk for as a first time younger head coach, but I think given where they are, I think the risk is worth the potential reward here.
Well, I could say the same thing, Stephen, about our good friends over at Brunt Workwear. It's worth the risk. Go check them out. BruntWorkwear.com/SEC to get you $10 off your first order over at BruntWorkwear.com. There's a link in the show notes, so go check them out yourself. It helps the show out. And really what it does, Stephen, is it helps the cousins out because they get money off on an outstanding product like a Brunt Work boot or your long sleeve t-shirts. We know how you feel about long sleeve t-shirts, Stephen. And they got other shirts as well, not just a long sleeve, but go check them out, help support the show, and get you some fine quality boots from Brunt Workwear that you could get your work done. You could cut some trees. Stephen is still picking up mangled trees over here at his dad's house. So I would hope that you got your Brunt Workwear boots on while you're doing that, or even a night out on the town. Brunt, so fashionable. I mean, they're dual purpose, if you know what I'm saying.
I always like a good dual threat quarterback, Mike. So I like that, being able to wear them outside, be able to wear them out on when you're out with the missus out on a date. My dad this weekend, he said his work boots were getting a little thin. So I first thought, you know, Father's Day, get some Brunt work boots, get him set up. Maybe by then we'll have all these trees cleared off. So it's like,
absolutely. So go check them out again, BruntWorkwear.com/SEC, or just use the promo code SEC to get you $10 off over at Brunt. You know where they need $10 off is Vanderbilt. Come on, Steven. What are we optimistic about after we paid our quarterback probably like $3 million? He's never taken a snap in college football. We need all the money we can get in Nashville, thanks to it all going to Jared Curtis. Is that what you're most optimistic about with Vanderbilt, or is it something else?
Mike, 110%. It is Jared Curtis. Just say it out loud. Vanderbilt signed a 5-star quarterback. The best quarterback by some recruiting services. It's crazy to think that, but that's the era of college football that we're in, that Vanderbilt can use the NIL to sign a 5-star quarterback. So, if I'm a Vanderbilt fan, Diego Pavia is not going to be easy to replace. That production, that play, that leadership, everything he brought to the team. But you're replacing him with a 5-star quarterback. So, yes, I think Pavia will be missed, but I think the upside is someone like Jared Curtis, if that 5-star potential turns into production, this Vanderbilt offense may have some growing pains this year, but in 2027 and beyond, they're going to be set. And I think you got to feel pretty optimistic, too, about Tim Beck's ability to get the most out of Jared Curtis, too, considering what he was able to do with Diego Pavia. So up and down probably as a true freshman, but long term, I think you got to be very, very optimistic that a 5-star quarterback signed to Vanderbilt and Jared Curtis.
I think Cousin Mike's got an interesting comment here, Stephen. I'm 110% certain no one should rely on a true freshman quarterback for a successful season, says Cousin Mike. And I don't disagree. And that's going to piggyback off what I was going to ask you, Stephen. How much pressure... I believe when we, what was it, last week or the week prior, we were talking about pressure and on Jared Curtis. How much pressure, though, if any, is on Clark Lee and Tim Beck to play the right quarterback? Because maybe it's not Jared Curtis. You know, what if he's getting outperformed in camp and they're like, well, heck, we're already paying this kid. If we sit him on the bench, you think he's just going to sit on the bench for a whole year and then be like, all right, I can't wait for year two when Lane Kiffin's calling me. Kirby won't be calling him. Maybe Josh Heupel, whoever. You know what I mean? Like, is he just going to ride the pine? How much pressure will be on Clark Lee to play the right quarterback if it's close, or even if Jared Curtis isn't looking the best in camp?
It's a good debate, because I think in the big picture, it's almost – you know, Clark Lee's got a little bit of like house money to play with because of the last 2 years, because there was, you know, it felt like Vanderbilt was, after the winless season in SEC play, trying to figure out like, hey, where is this going? Then you figure out, okay, we got to invest in NIL. We got to get the portal classes going. They did that. And look where it's translated to back-to-back bowl games, nearly making the playoffs. So it feels like, given the relative expectations here, that a step back is not going to like necessarily increase the pressure 110% on Clark Lee. But I do think you bring up, I think, about Curtis, and I think there is a lot of pressure on his shoulders because five-star, yes, it's Vanderbilt. There won't be as much scrutiny as it is going to Alabama or Georgia. But I still think Pavia was so good. You're being counted on as the next savior. If things don't work out, if you do get benched, where do you go from here? So, yeah, I think it's incumbent on Clark Lee and the staff to bring him along and to say, here at Vanderbilt, we can help you if you're a five-star reach your potential, because that could be a good selling point for this team on the recruiting trail. Whereas if he goes and struggles, going to be a lot of questions that, oh, it was just Diego Pavia. It was just a 1-2 year kind of thing. Do you think that's fair?
I do. And I also think this is fair. Shout out Steven Up. He says Jalen Hurts did pretty well as a freshman, won SEC Offensive Player of the Year, if you recall. Now, he also had Lane Kiffin as his play caller, and he had a wealth of talent. He had Nick Saban as his head coach, obviously. But I certainly think more than anything that talent around him assisted him. But, and of course, Jalen Hurts has gone on. He's won the national or the Super Bowl. So we know what kind of special player he was. But, hey, that's what some people are, that fair or not, that's what some people probably expect from Jared Curtis now. Oh, so he's got to live up to that. But maybe he is, if he's Jalen Hurts 2.0, and I know they're completely different players, but if he is worth the hype, essentially, maybe that's a better way to say it. If he's worth the hype, then he'll probably be fine this year.
Can Vanderbilt afford Jared Curtis to just be okay, though? Don't they kind of need to be really good?
I think without a doubt they need him to be a difference maker.
Yeah, I think so too. And I think you would have liked to have keep guys like Trey Richardson around if you're Vanderbilt, because I think he had that playmaking ability. There's no more Eli Stowers. Your offensive line is brand new. I think if this Vanderbilt team had a defense that was kind of at the top of the SEC and most of the guys were coming back, they had an experienced offensive line. I think there's a chance for him to be more of a caretaker, but I don't think that runway is going to be there. I think he's going to have to be good from day one and probably be asked to do a lot, given how valuable Pavia was, how valuable that offense kind of flows through the quarterback. Also, just given where this team is, I think there's pressure right away to just be like the guy, to be like the five-star and come in and hit right away.
Mm-hmm. All right, let's move on, Steven, to Missouri. They have already started spring. They've got a new quarterback and, well, not technically, not yet. But they won't name him the starter, Steven. By God, he's going to have to earn his way, Austin Simmons is. And they've got a completely retooled defense. But we're not looking at that. We're looking at optimism. What are you most optimistic with Missouri as they are already in spring?
Mike, this might be Captain Obvious, but Missouri might have the best backfield in college football this year. Jamal Roberts and Ahmad Hardy. That 1-2 punch, I'm sure when everybody ranks the backfields, they're going to be in the top five. Some people might have them at the top, wherever they are. Given that they have zero returning starters, given they have a new quarterback, given they have turnover at receiver, you've got three starters back on your offensive line. You've got these two running backs. You know your foundation. These guys are going to come downhill and they're going to run the ball on you. And that's going to give Austin Simmons time. That's going to give the defense some time to kind of figure out who they are. So, like I said, Mike, this one, given the turnover, given some of the other questions, is pretty easy. It's got to be that you've got one of the best backfields in the country. Ahmad Hardy is going to be a first-team All-American for me, I know, this offseason. And Jamal Roberts is pretty good too. So that combo can carry this Missouri team as it develops the rest of the squad.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't know if you've heard it, Steven, but Ahmad Hardy's got four horses this year. drink Let That Be Known. So I think that's interesting. But I also think, you know how we get fired up. We've said it a couple times already on this show, Steve, with something new at Arkansas, new at Kentucky. You know, we get all, you know, Florida, Auburn, which I'm not saying they shouldn't be fired up, but I think we probably get carried away with that as opposed to looking at programs that have already proven in this conference they can win, like Missouri, mm-hmm. like a Tennessee, like an Ole Miss, that they can sustain this. They know what it takes. They've built the foundation's already laid, so to speak. So the fact that, yeah, maybe last year didn't go your way, I don't think the where you're trying to get, so to speak, the road to where you really want to be, it's not near as far as it is in Columbia than it is in Auburn and Florida and places like this. Yet I think we lose sight because it's not that newness. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. I think the optimism of some of those new coaches is certainly going to sell. Whereas I think if we kind of take a step back and just look at the Missouri track record the last couple of seasons, what is it, Mike, 29 wins over the last 3 years? But also I think a coaching staff that has excelled in this era of finding the right pieces through the portal, being able to reload, being able to get the most out of the roster. Certainly plenty of questions here, but the floor is already at the level of, hey, they've been right there at 8, 10, 11 victories the last couple of years. So you're not starting from scratch necessarily. There is that zero returning starters on defense, but I think you kind of trust, there's a little bit more of a trust factor. They've proven this in the SEC, whereas some of the other guys are truly starting of they, it's a lot of optimism. We think they're going to be good. We've seen it out of Missouri.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we have. And we have seen it, Stephen, at Tennessee. That's why it's kind of it's a similar deal here. But again, last year did not go as expected. What are you most optimistic for Tennessee going into, what is this, year 6, I believe, of the Josh Heupel era?
Mike, I think it has to be Jim Knowles, because this is kind of a similar discussion that we had with Mississippi State. You trust the coach, the head coach that is an offensive minded guy. You trust him to figure things out. I do think it's going to take some time with Tennessee's quarterback battle. And, you know, the Brazel's off to the NFL. They got some guys to replace. But I think if anything, the defense took such a step back last year that if you can raise the floor on your defense, it gives the offense some time to figure out kind of like what it is and give the quarterback some time to develop. I mean, Tennessee was just one of the nation's best defenses just, you know, a couple of years ago. So it's not like that this is a huge mountain to climb. But I think with Knowles, yeah, things didn't go well at Penn State, but the totality of the track record there, he's one of the best defensive coordinators in the country. I like the fact that they brought in like Chaz Coleman at defensive end. You look at Amari Campbell at linebacker, DeJuan Lane in the secondary. It's like Tennessee brought in three guys from Penn State who can help the transition this defense to the Knowles scheme. So one guy at every level, they brought in some assistants. It feels like that get it up to speed timeline is going to be a lot quicker than we saw. And what you kind of heard that it takes Knowles maybe 2 years. So I just think if I'm a Tennessee fan, I'm sitting here saying Heupel has done a good job of adapting. They've built good run games. I trust Heupel to figure out the quarterback. He may have hired a top five defensive coordinator. That'd be my reason for optimism, that the defense would not take long to turn things around this year.
Mm-hmm. And he just signed. But I mean, I don't know if we sit around and rank these guys, but the strength coach from Indiana. Yeah. I mean, I think, again, every strength coach hires, man, these guys never look bigger, never look stronger. Man, they're working them hard. You know what I mean? Which it's so overblown. But when you literally hire the guy that built the Indiana National Championship squad, I am buying into that. I think that's a little different, but because that's, yeah, I think it goes without saying, Stephen, that Tennessee was I think they were lacking in toughness and physicality. Particularly, it showed against Vanderbilt, I thought. So, you know, if they can turn that around, I think that's another reason for optimism. And that'll lead to better defense because you're tougher, you're physical, you can tackle better. It kind of goes hand in hand.
I can't wait for all those off-season stories about how great the workouts are. Like the guys are flipping over tires. They're doing these workouts. They've looked unstoppable. Every time you get a new strength and conditioning coach, it's very, very predictable to see the new stories. But you're 100% right. I think this is kind of a hire, and we talked about it when Tennessee made the move, is you have to find ways on the margins to get better. Because I think, you know, everybody's trying to get to the top. You're trying to get back to the playoff. If you're Tennessee, you know, you, like I said, you trust Heupel on the offense. You kind of have a head coach of the defense in Jim Knowles. So how else do you take the big swing and try to get back to the playoff? Well, let's get better at strength and conditioning, because you could finish the games like the Oklahoma game, like the Vanderbilt game. That could be the difference between 9-3 and 10-2. So as much as we could kind of poke fun at the stories that are probably going to come out of it, I do think there is a real chance that if you get a little bit better conditioning, you're a little tougher in the fourth quarter, that might make a difference in some of these one score games and help Tennessee get back to the playoff in short order, whether that's 2026 or 27-28.
Yeah. And you talked about this too with Jim Knowles, and everybody brings it up. And I think it is fair because I've studied the man's track record that it can take a while to get going. Now it didn't at Ohio State. Of course, he's walking into a fantastic situation with elite talent. And there's about three good teams in that conference. So a little different story. But the fact that it didn't go as expected last year, and the fact that that is a knock on him, yet, I mean, considering what they're paying him, he better reevaluate what he's doing in the offseason to kind of speed that up. And I think bringing coaches with him, bringing players with him, I think they're well aware that that is a reality, and they're looking into how they can expedite that process.
And I think the odds of like Heupel being on the hot seat this year are like, if they were to go 2-10, some disaster, it's a different conversation. But I also think there's got to be some urgency here. And I think we've seen kind of Heupel talk about this offseason and not just settling for complacency. So I think that complacency of just coming in and saying it can't be 2 years, it's got to be now. The urgency based upon what happened last year. I think for anybody who may have some doubts about Jim Knowles, I mean, Ohio State had great players. Like you said, Mike, the offenses aren't very good. Jim Knowles built some good defenses at Duke and Oklahoma State, two places where it's not necessarily easy to build good defenses. So I think his track record at Ohio State was very good, but I also think outside of that, there's been a lot of success. And I think that urgency of, hey, it failed last year, we don't have 2 years to get this done, we've got to get progress this year, I suspect Tennessee's going to have a much improved defense this year.
All right. Well, Stephen, I'm seeing a lot of Cox in the comments. So how about that game, Cox? Reason for optimism coming off a rough year, but they got a lot of talent to work with. What's got you most optimistic about Shane Beamer's South Carolina program?
Hang with me. It's been an offensive offseason. not in the term you might be thinking. It's been a great offseason for South Carolina's offense, because that's the side of the ball that needed a fresh start. They hire Kendall Briles, who should fit well with Lenora Sellers. Lenora Sellers is back. Nick Harbor's back. Like, they retained the guys that they needed to, and they upgraded at the coordinator spot. I also think that style of offense will help them maximize some of the talent of Sellers, some of the guys around him. So all of the parts, whether it's the portal, Jacarius Peak doesn't look like he's going to be out, you know, most of the season now. The weaknesses, they've attacked them. They've retained potentially a first-round pick at quarterback, and they've upgraded at the offensive coordinator position. So the biggest question we had about South Carolina at the end of the year, I think it's fair to say they've answered that, and that gives them a chance to get back into the top 25 this year.
Well, I will address what you said in just a moment, Stephen. I want to shout out our other Stephen.
Way showing up for them boys in Tuscaloosa. It's Stephen up. Roll Tide.
Shout out, Steve it up for the donation. Always appreciate Lassen's analysis, helping us cousins get through the off season. Thank you, Steve it up.
Appreciate you, Steve it up.
And we will get to Alabama before long, no doubt. But is there a shot, Steven, that, because again, I'm a believer in the Gamecocks. I want to see them do well. But fool me once, shame on you. What was it George Bush said? Fool me again. Yeah. Fool us all or whatever. But could it be that, you know, maybe that 9-3 was an outlier and we're fools for those of us that believe in the Gamecocks?
There's always a chance. I guess maybe the way that I look at it is we saw it happen with the right pieces. It can happen again. And we just kind of talked about all the weaknesses that they had. And like I said, I feel like they've answered them this offseason. Now, it doesn't mean that they're going to go to the playoff like Shane Beamer has suggested. But also, I feel like if you want to maximize the talent of Lenora Sellers, somebody like Kendall Briles can do it. Certainly, Mike, the schedule, when you just, you know, 9 games in the SEC, we've talked about it with a lot of these teams, at Alabama, at Florida, at Oklahoma, Texas A&M, Georgia, at Clemson. It's pretty hard. So I understand what you're kind of like you're getting at as there needs to be more, I guess, of an extended track record. And any time off of a disappointment, you do wonder how far this team can rebound. The other side of it is like there's a pretty good opportunity to buy low here based upon the offseason acquisitions.
Right. And I don't know how valuable this truly is, Steven. And it's hokey when it doesn't pay off, but there's a lot of talk of the culture at Carolina and guys wanting to be there. And I think that's valid. You know, they haven't had necessarily a mass exodus despite coordinator change. And, you know, I'm, you know, it's not like Sellers and Dylan Stewart and Nick Harbor. They're not doing it for free, but nobody is, you know what I mean? So, but point being, they had options. I don't know how seriously they looked around, if at all. But there was a lot of rumors, Miami and LSU and a lot of these other guys were after some of these key players, yet they remain. Is there anything to be said, you know, similar like I was saying to Missouri and Tennessee, where they have proven it in this conference, that we should give them a little bit of the benefit of the doubt? And South Carolina has not proven it to that degree, even though they did 2 seasons ago. But should they be given any benefit of the doubt that even after a rough season that they can kind of lock in and it won't haunt them in 26, if that makes sense?
I think you can make that argument. I think good culture kind of, and of course, culture is kind of a funny, like, figure 10, like how do you figure that into some of these teams? Because you hear about it, but like, it's hard for us to kind of know, like, behind the scenes and you know, in front of the magazine, like, what does it all mean for the season? So I think you kind of have to go on like what we've seen, which is like the player retention. There hasn't been like a mass exodus of players. You know, some guys left, obviously they weren't necessarily key players, but also I just think this 4-8, 1-7, last year was Shane Beamer's worst year. It came after his best season of 9-4. So we kind of seen the highs and the lows in the 2-year window. So I think the fact they were able to retain those guys, plus you hear that culture talk, what they've added, that's kind of why I'm willing to give them the benefit of the doubt here and say that 4-8 may be more of an outlier, and it'd be pretty shocking to see a repeat of that absent like a lot of injuries this year.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, are you buying Auburn and their new look under Alex Golish? What are you most optimistic about with the Tigers?
This would be a shocker, Mike. It's offense, a new offense. So, Mike, let me read you these not safe for work numbers on what Hugh Freeze's offense put down at Auburn. In SEC only games, they were 9th, 14th, and 14th in scoring offense. Horrific numbers for a guy who was an offensive mastermind, right? Well, Alex Golish knows how to score points. We saw this at South Florida over his tenure there. Of course, he's got ties in the past to Tennessee. Bringing in Byron Brown, I think he's going to speed up that transition period. They added Bryson Washington, the Baylor running back transfer. They've added skilled talent from South Florida. So I actually think Alex Golish knows what he's doing on the offensive side of the ball. Unlike the last guy, I think Byron Brown's got a chance to be top, you know, five-ish type quarterback in the SEC if he can make that fast transition to a higher level of ball. I like the where this is going, because I think you also think DJ Durkin, a lot of turnover, pretty good track record on the defensive side of the ball. You pair that with a high kind of powered offense, and I think Auburn's got something good going. So I am a little skeptical about that offensive line. That might be the one thing that's kind of holding me back from buying a little bit more Auburn stock this year. But a fresh start by a guy who knows what he's doing on offense, that's why I'm optimistic for Auburn.
You shared a lot of figures there, Stephen. You did not share Hugh Freeze's handicap. I hear it's down because he's been getting so many logging so many hours, more of the hours than even Cousin Shane on the golf course. I mean, that he was working on that at least, wasn't he?
Yeah, he was good at that, wasn't he? He's good at apparently like Instagram things too. Have you ever thought about you know, having like that SEC podcast golf tournament? Let Shane and Hugh Freeze tee this one off.
I have it, but now I have to do it. So thank you for putting that into the universe. That shall be done. But
Gus Malzahn's available too.
We were talking last week, Stephen, of which we were asked in the mailbag episode, which position group on offense and defense will improve the most? And let's just focus on offense here in the conference. Shane and I both said Auburn. Could you see that being the case? And I think we overlooked LSU. We probably shouldn't have. But if you had to pick one more improved based on last year, LSU offense, Auburn offense, or is there perhaps another one that you think would be a better candidate?
I would probably go LSU slightly over Auburn. I will also point out, Mike, that Florida was last in the SEC in scoring offense, and I trust the heck out of Buster Faulkner and some of the skill talent that Florida has. So I could see Florida kind of creeping in this discussion too, but I'd probably go LSU. It's hard to pick against Lane Kiffin's offense here.
But Auburn is at least in the conversation, right?
Yeah, 100%. I think I'd probably go LSU, Auburn, then Florida, maybe on the trio of on the ranking of those trio of schools of most improved offenses.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, hey, you just talked a little bit about Florida. What are you most optimistic for the Gators going into year one of the John Sumrall era?
Mike, I think we could go a couple different directions here because they've got one of the best running backs in the country. Jaden Baugh is coming back this year. You've got a trio of receivers that's got the potential to be very good. And as I was putting this list together, the one thing I kept coming back to is, man, they have good players, right? We saw this under Billy Napier. They just could not get the most out of that. So I think the reason that I would be most optimistic for Florida is John Sumrall. I think his track record of winning at Troy, winning at Tulane, I know it's a different level, but he's steeped in SEC territory. I mean, he's from the footprint. He's been an assistant. He's been a player. He's coached at two G5 schools. Troy and Tulane, he's been a head coach for 4 years. He took all four of those teams to the conference title. So he's pretty dang good at getting the most out of the roster and under some pretty challenging circumstances of how much G5 schools change rosters so much. So I'm looking at this as which coach could come in right away and get the most out of the roster and maybe surprise some people. I think it's got to be Florida. I think that if you add in Buster Faulkner's ability to develop Aaron Filo, you've got Jaden Baugh, you've got these receivers, you got Brad White and Sumrall fixing the defense. I like where Florida's going here. So I think it's coaching staff upgrades and starting with John Sumrall.
Mm-hmm. I just thought of something, Stephen. And again, there's literally no way to evaluate this. We'll put a metric to it or anything like that. But when it comes to these first-year coaches, and particularly Sumrall, Golish, they're probably on their own island in terms of what I'm about to say here. And maybe even Kiffin. But is there any way to kind of prepare oneself for dealing with these fans?
Yeah.
And I mean that with all due respect, because we don't even have his show without the great fans. You know what I mean? But, you know, the first time Summerall screws up or Golish, and again, I don't even know if you could put Kiffin into that conversation, but just given the expectations and the demands, hell, all these LSU people, Stephen, God, they tried to tell me this time last year when I said, Brian Kelly, that's not the guy. They would bend over backwards to defend that man, right? And then he lost a couple games. His ass got to go. I'm not putting Kiffin in that category. He's been in the SEC. So, you know, there won't be that much of an adjustment for him. But I don't think he's ever had this level of expectations short of maybe 24 Ole Miss, and he didn't meet them. But particularly Summerall and Golish, is there any way to prep yourself for what you're walking into?
That's a great question. I think the answer is probably not. I mean, I just think about, like, me from an information nerd and trying to find information on some of these teams. It's like worlds different. Like Florida, the vast amount of information you can find, the people that cover Florida, way different than like Tulane. I mean, obviously the Saints take up so much of the New Orleans media. So, Mike, it is a totally different world. And it's not just whether you win or lose, it's like every decision. It's like that third down run on third and seven. It's the fourth and two call. So yes, it is a totally different world, and they will absolutely have to adjust to it. And we've seen coaches too. I mean, some coaches have really struggled in these bigger environments where they go to at a bigger job. They thrived at a lower school, but the scrutiny, the pressure, you mentioned Kiffin, the pressure is a little bit different there. It's like, hey, 10-2 is not good enough, right? It's got to be win the national title good. So the levels of pressure and how these coaches handle it, whether it's first year, Kiffin, I think it's going to be a fascinating experiment to watch this season and even beyond to see if all these guys can handle that SEC scrutiny or the scrutiny of trying to win a national title at LSU.
Yeah, word of advice to Summerall, don't call out the fans living in their basement talking crap about your program like old Billy Napier. The moment he did that, I knew he was a goner. There was no coming back from that one. You know what?
Don't take the advice of Dan Enos to email people after games either.
All right, Stephen, moving on. Texas A&M. What a year till the very end. But hell, still a great year. Year two under Mike Elko. Reason for most optimism with the Aggies going into year three of the Elko era.
Let me see, Mike, if you agree with my optimism here. I think it's a trajectory that is believable and sustainable. We talked a little bit about this last week when, you know, Fisher had that one season where they almost went to the playoff, but you still kind of had doubts, you know, about Fisher. And even though maybe the recruiting was going well, it's always hard to figure out like what's real and what's not on some of these teams because rosters and coaches change so much. We've had over 60 something coaching changes in the last 2 years. You know, you could nitpick about A&M and say, okay, the schedule was favorable last year, but I think by all the metrics, they were a top 10 team. If you just took away the schedule and just looked at how they played, they beat Notre Dame on the road. They almost went to the SEC championship. It feels like this program is getting further and further away from all those. They can only get to 8 wins. The way they're recruiting, the way they're developing, the portal, the way they've maximized their transfers the last couple years, this feels way more sustainable to me and believable than ever under Jimbo Fisher. And I think why you have to be optimistic about that is, it's like, look at the offensive line turnover. Look at Casey Concepcion going to the NFL, the turnover on defense. And this is still maybe a top 10 team. I think it kind of goes back to Mike Elko and just thinking that, hey, this trajectory is real and that they're still going to be very, very good again this year.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's someone coming in there and actually utilizing the resources instead of chasing stars, calling shots in the media, threatening Nick Saban. You know, it's just a completely, you know, I don't think Coach Elko's going to win any popularity contests. I don't think he's going to be having any viral comments unless he's yelling at somebody to shut the door. But, you know, and again, I don't think he gives a damn about all that because he's just a football coach that wants to deliver A&M a championship. And there's no reason they're not in that conversation basically year in and year out with the with all the resources and everything they've got to throw at it.
And isn't like I would agree with you about I don't care if like my head coach, if like he's the most boring head coach in the world at the press conference and stuff. As long as he's winning games, that's all that matters, right? And I think he's delivered that in his first couple of years. But also, when he was hired, I think that the thing that I kept coming back to is you look at his track record at Duke, he's just a football coach. And they have all these great resources at Texas A&M. They needed somebody who was going to say, this, this, and this, I'm going to work to get this program to the next level. I am going to take advantage of it. I'm not going to talk about national championships. I'm not going to print the banners. We're not going to do that. We're going to do the hard work, and it's going to be hard, but we're going to get it done. And I think that's kind of like that blue collar work mentality, I think is what Texas A&M needed. Figure out all these great resources, utilize it. And that's the way by putting in that hard work. That's what Elko's done so far.
All right, Steven, let's move on to Alabama for Steven Up. Shout out to Crimson Tide. What are you most optimistic about, Steven, for Kalen DeBoer's program going into year three, coming off a playoff appearance?
I'm going to be very interested to see what Steven Up says about this one. So I'm going to I went with a couple different directions, or I should say I toyed with a couple different directions. I toyed with the idea, Mike, of saying Alabama's under the radar. Kalen DeBoer can use that as motivation. Everybody believes that Alabama's fallen off, but they still got a lot of good players in Tuscaloosa. I also think the secondary is going to be pretty dang good for this Alabama team next year. But you got to go back to the quarterback, right? Keelan Russell, former five-star. You know, you see his limited snaps and you see the potential, the dual threat ability, the arm. Like, there's a lot to work with here. And Ryan Grubb and Kalen DeBoer, that duo, they developed Michael Penix at Washington. You know, they've obviously what they did with Ty Simpson, first, second round pick this year. Think you can make the argument his ceiling's higher than all those guys. And so I know he's got to hold off Austin Mack. I know they've got to get the run game going. The offensive line is revamped, but if I'm Alabama, I'm looking at Keelan Russell saying, if he's really good, everybody's picking Alabama to finish in the 20s or 15s could be really off come December. So I think the optimism has to be a quarterback with a lot of upside.
Yeah, I can't remember. I know it's happened, but I can't remember the last time Alabama wasn't picked to contend for the SEC championship. And yeah, I'm sure there'll be some people that, some homers that predict this team will. And I'm not saying they can't, but let me put it to you this way. Again, I don't even know how many people actually vote in those things. I don't pay too much attention. But at SEC Media Days, let's say there's typically 400. I don't even know. 400 people that voted in the media poll. Out of 400, Steven, how many do you think are picking Bama to win the SEC?
This year?
Mm-hmm.
I'd say probably 10 or fewer, maybe.
Yeah, I think I was going to say maybe around 20, but
okay, yeah.
I mean, and that's probably too high. So I think you're probably right on. So again, what a position to be in. As your program is coming off a season where you won a playoff game. Let's not focus on how it ended. But you won a playoff game. That's more than the vast majority of programs in the country could say.
I was going to say this like in a nice way. I think there's going to be some homer media that votes for Alabama. And I don't mean that in a mean way to any of them. There will be some Alabama guys who probably vote for them. But I mean, doesn't somebody vote for Vanderbilt too to win the SEC every year? So
Vanderbilt usually gets a couple votes. So
yeah,
take that for what it's worth, you know?
Yeah, I mean, and honestly, those of us in the media, we got some work to do in our preseason predictions because they haven't been very good. Although I feel pretty good about Georgia and Texas this year. But of course, that may not age very well if Alabama and Keelan Russell or LSU, somebody at Texas A&M, Oklahoma, a lot of intrigue at the top this year.
Yeah, so maybe that's a perfect spot to not be considered a favorite to win it all, because that's generally where even the Indiana, I heard this the other day. You correct me if I'm wrong, Steven, but I heard that the Big Ten media, they voted Indiana sixth.
I think that's right. If somebody can correct me on this, I don't think the Big Ten media actually does a media poll conducted by the conference. Why, I don't know. I think a newspaper actually accumulates all of that, and I think they were sixth in that this year.
Yeah.
So, I mean...
What do we know? You know what? Right.
I mean, that in logically, like, you know, Ohio State, Penn State, Oregon, like, it made sense in the preseason, I guess. We were way wrong.
All right. I can imagine you have no shortage of talking points for optimism for LSU going into year one of the Lane Kiffin era. What have you kind of centered this on, though, Steven?
Mike, I hate to be boring, but I will. It's Lane Kiffin's arrival, because it's not just Lane Kiffin's arrival as top 10 coach in college football. He's done it in this era, the portal, the NIL. He's been, you know, thriving at revamping these rosters with all the changes in the sport. And LSU's going through a massive roster overhaul. And I also look at the offensive side of the ball, a place where LSU really needs to make up some ground. Brought in Sam Levitt, Jordan Seaton on the offensive line. They've restocked the receivers. They've got a couple pretty good running backs, I think. I think Lane Kiffin's done a good job of getting the most out of running backs. So I know it's boring. I know there's a lot of drama with Kiffin. But I also think that if LSU picked a top 10 coach who's getting the most out of talent in this era, that combination could help this program turn things around quickly.
And hey, worst case scenario, Steven, if things go sideways and they underperform, we at least know it's going to be entertaining.
Yes.
There's going to be no shortage of, you know, commentary and people trolling and all kinds of goodness when it comes to Lane quitting down in Baton Rouge. You know what?
Absolutely, Mike. But not only that, can you imagine what the reaction is going to be this year if Ole Miss is significantly better than LSU? And Ole Miss goes back to the playoff and LSU sitting at home at 7-5, maybe going back to the Texas Bowl or playing in the Music City Bowl this year. Can you imagine the trolling that's going to go on after that?
I could see Kiffin using that to promote his LSU program, you know? I built that program. Come play at LSU. You're something stupid like that, you know?
He might deactivate his Twitter account for a couple of weeks.
All right. Well, hey, let's just transition right to that then. Ole Miss, what are you most optimistic as there's still high hopes in Oxford with new coaching staff relatively? And I know there's some holdovers, but, and you know, a roster that is somewhat in transition, but many, many, many key players are back. Playoffs or being discussed in Oxford once again. I mean, this, talk about an annual playoff program. Maybe Ole Miss is there. What's your most optimistic thing with the Rebels?
I think it has to be Ole Miss can keep this rolling. And certainly Lane Kiffin, like I said, is a top 10 coach. I think Pete Golding's off to a good start, though. It's the on-field wins. I mean, they were handful of plays away from going to the national championship. That win over Georgia was huge. I think just in terms of boosting my confidence about where this program can still go under Pete Golding. There's a lot to prove. You know, it's so much easier though to take over a team and then take it over in a full season. Like, it's easy just to kind of keep it going and then start over the next year. But I think if you're starting with Trinidad Chambliss and Kewon Lacy, and you've done a good job in the portal again, and there's been a track record of, hey, Ole Miss is one of the leaders in the NIL space, and they've been one of the leaders from the start at being aggressive in the portal, it also feels pretty sustainable. And so I like what Golding has done so far on the field, off the field. You got two of the best players in the SEC in Chambliss and Lacey coming back. I think they can keep this rolling. So I think the transition is always a concern, but there's enough here for Ole Miss to feel good about 2026, I think.
Yeah, and there's always these coaches, right, where we don't necessarily have them pegged as the next great coach. Doesn't mean that they aren't, right? And I know this is not going to age well, but at the time, like Dabo, who in the hell saw that coming? You know, and then he wins multiple national championships. There's no reason to believe Pete Golding. Cheat Golding. We know he'll do whatever it takes to win, and maybe that's what you need. You know what?
Is Cheat Golding on a shirt for that SEC podcast store? Please tell me it is.
Not yet, but we need to do it.
Man, Portal Pete, Cheat Golding, man, you can sell both sides of the equation here. I think if anything, that introductory kind of deal we saw with Pete Golding kind of gave some valuable insight. It's like, hey, this thing isn't broken. I'm just going to put some tweaks on it. We're going to keep it rolling. And we might find out that in 2 years from now that the job was just too big for him. But also, I think given the circumstances of the timing of that hire, he was the best hire to keep this going. If you couldn't get John Sumrall, if you couldn't get Alex Golish, you know, pick the guy who's been a good defensive coordinator, who's steeped into what you're doing, and just keep it going. So it is a big step up to take over a program over a full season. But I think my confidence level grew quite a bit after seeing this team play in the playoff and seeing what they've done in the offseason. So I like where Ole Miss is headed into 2026.
Yeah, I mean, it was very brief, but I think it's completely fair to say Ole Miss got better when Kiffin left.
It's bold.
Well, I mean, one of them lost to Georgia, one didn't, Stephen.
Just Trinidad Chambliss was unbelievable in that game, too. So
Yeah, no doubt. All right, well, speaking of optimism, what are you optimistic about? Were the Oklahoma Sooners coming off a playoff appearance, a home playoff appearance at that? What's got you fired up about the Sooners?
Mike, the offense feels like it's on the right track. And if the offense is on the right track, we know Brent Venables is going to put together a good defense. So it feels like Oklahoma's got a chance to get back to the playoff and potentially win some games. I look at this offense and go a healthy John Mateer over a full season, it's got to equal better results. So you've got Mateer and Arbuckle. They're now seasoned SEC vets. So they've been through this conference. Mateer's healthy. That should pay off. But not only that, the offensive line bringing back four starters and including some guys like, you know, Fasusi and some of those others who were growing up last year in the SEC. Plus, you throw in an upgrade at tight end. Plus, you add more weapons at receiver. If all that works out to where you've got some help from a tier, the run game's better. I mean, this offense could be, I know we talked about Florida, we talked about LSU, we talked about Auburn, but I think there's a world here where these pieces and these moves plus experience equal a much improved Oklahoma offense, which either offsets maybe some of the losses on defense or just elevates this team back into the playoffs. So I think the offense on the right track is my biggest reason for optimism.
Right. And clearly when they came into the conference, they were not up to standard. Now you could probably blame that on transition, you know, new coaching. Now you can't completely blame it on that, but I do think, obviously, Texas was identified where they needed to get better. They were elite on the line of scrimmage, and it's translated to a lot of success in this conference. And I think you started to see that. Well, you did see that with Oklahoma last year with their defensive line, and now the offensive line coming together. So, yeah, I think that not just those two, but obviously every program in this conference, that's critical. But now that they've kind of adjusted to it and maybe just getting better on the offensive line, that should really serve them well.
Yeah, I think a major kind of under the radar storyline in college football is some of the offensive line play has been kind of iffy at a lot of schools. And I think some of it is transfers. I think some of it is all the coaching changes has made it hard for these guys to develop. But, and I think I'll be curious to see, like, some of these teams, like in Oklahoma, that brings back a four starters on the offensive line, they averaged under 22 points a game in SEC play last year. So how, like, when we step back in December and we see how these offenses performed, how much better does that experience in the offensive line translate into points? Because it does feel like if you're going to be better and more experienced up front, it feels like that's one place you probably want to be a little bit older at is on the offensive line. So I think that's a good reason for Oklahoma to be optimistic this year, is sort of like internal growth plus the external transfers coming in and Mateer's better health this year.
Mm-hmm. All right, Stephen, I think this one will be fairly easy, but I'm curious to see where you went. How about Georgia, the class of the SEC the last two seasons? What are you most optimistic about with the Dogs?
Georgia returns a team that is capable of getting back to the top of college football. I think that's what I would be optimistic about if I'm a Georgia fan. Because Gunnar Stockton's in his second year. They've got a good running game. I think the offensive line will be fine too. Defensively, eight returning starters. Certainly going to miss CJ Allen, Dalen Everett. But I think this group's going to be one of the best in the SEC. So 14 returning starters. You know, what does that mean in this era? It's the most in the SEC. Georgia felt like if they had won the Sugar Bowl, it was probably going to go on a run too. So I just feel like this Georgia team, with the returning talent and the track record, this team is capable of winning the national championship. And if I'm a Georgia fan, I am very optimistic about that returning experience translating back into a title.
Yeah, I think you're 100% right. And I wonder, now we got to maybe find a new talking point, but seems like every year they have a playoff failure. You wonder how much that'll motivate them, because, you know, until they're dethroned, they're the class of the conference, but you could go from that to missing the playoffs in a hurry. You know, I mean, look no further than Alabama post Nick Saban. You know, the drop off can be quick and mighty, and I'm not suggesting Georgia's going to be falling off anytime soon. I don't anticipate that probably ever happens under Kirby Smart, but who knows how long he'll even be there. So there is, at least in my mind, Stephen, I don't know, would you agree with this or not, that they've really got to seize this opportunity while it's there after the last 3 years not getting at least one title there feels like a big miss.
Georgia feels pretty recession-proof under Kirby Smart to me, you know, kind of like Ohio State is. You just see year over year winning 9-10 games or more than that. I think maybe the way that, and I would agree kind of with your assessment, and I think maybe the way to look at this is, it is a lot harder to win a title in 2026 and beyond because you do have to win the 12-teamer. In the past, it was the BCS. It was just two. Then it was four. Now it was 12. Georgia probably has, I mean, if you look at the five-year trend of roster talent, Alabama and Georgia are like neck and neck right now. And it's not really accounting for attrition, but they are still ahead of everybody else. But it's, you know, once you're in that window, you've got to capitalize on it. And you start adding more variables in the process of more games. You could have more injuries in those games, a lot of other variables. A lot could go wrong, and it gets harder to win a title. So I think it is harder on one count for Georgia. On the other count, I still think that this is the standard right now in college football. And as long as Kirby Smart is there, it feels like you got to pencil them in as one of the top 3 to 5 contenders to win it all.
Well, Steven, I saved the best in your mind for the last. What are you most optimistic with Texas? And please don't say Arch, because we know you're going to say Arch.
March Madness? Shoot, I was thinking Arch Madness. I didn't want to mention Arch Manning's growth because I felt like that was going to be too obvious. So I kind of went with an offensive plan is coming together. You know, you can kind of loop Arch into this too, because he didn't play well at the start of last year, but he kind of settled in over the second half and certainly over the last third of the season. His development is key, another offseason to do so, but also the running game. I think you'll see a much improved running game. Hollywood Smothers, very good at breaking tackles, between the tackles runs too. Relik Brown, the Arizona State transfer, all-purpose player. Cam Coleman, he's a number one receiver. I think the offensive line is going to be better too, Mike. So it feels like, yes, Arch Manning's development is going to be key, but there's also kind of a total sum of the parts here, and you're able to run the ball better. You protect the quarterback. You get receivers that actually catch the ball, maybe. All those things. This offensive plan is coming together, which helps Texas get back in the playoff. And if you hope Will Muschamp elevates your defense, there's the argument for Texas to be preseason number one or number two.
Mm-hmm. Surprise, surprise that he was going to say that. But no, I hear you. And I don't necessarily disagree with any of that. I'm a little concerned as we're going to this 9-game SEC, as we remain in a multi-round playoff, 12-team playoff, if you will, that your depth will be tested like never before. And I'm kind of curious to know where Texas is in that regard. I'm not saying they don't have good players, because they certainly do. I think they probably have the best front line players in the conference. But I question the depth. Is that fair?
It is, because I think we saw this offseason that some of the portal losses kind of decimated the depth, and especially in the SEC. I don't, you know, with 9 games plus the playoff pursuit, if you have an injury, they missing one of their top offensive linemen last year, or shouldn't say they should not missing one of their top, one of their guys was supposed to be one of their top, either six man or starter was out for the year, and the offensive line depth was a real issue. I will note, and I think this is interesting, Mike. I was going through some other teams and other conferences. So this is, take this with a grain of salt. San Diego State, on how many players they play, they actually have a chart on their roster, how many guys played each game. On average, it's about 58 to 60, which I found to be pretty interesting, because we had talked about that after Texas lost some of the guys that they were trying to accumulate the top like 60 to 65 players. Like, you're investing in those guys. So I think you kind of see that in college football right now. The question is, like, when you have an injury, where is it? Like, is it on the offensive line and you really don't have a lot of depth there? Do you lose Arch Manning and you have to go to somebody who's younger and maybe has a lot of upside, but maybe needs some time? So I am concerned about that, but I'm also looking at it as, if your best chance is to invest in those 60 to 70 players, you do it and chase that title. And that's kind of where it feels like Texas is headed this year.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I think it's a fair assessment. And pardon me if I don't believe I've asked you this, Stephen, because I think this came out since we last spoke, but I just popped into my mind that the NCAA is trying to get ahead of post-spring transfers. I can't for the life of me recall the NCAA being ahead on anything, but I think they might be in this instance. What did you have any reaction to that?
I think it is. Well, let me say this, Mike. The lawyers hate it, which means it's probably a good policy. I think if you want to know why the NCAA is worried about this, if you think last year there were a couple players who unenrolled and then enrolled at another school outside of the transfer windows. And what they're trying to do is say, no, this is the window that you're going to have the player movement, because you're trying to set the roster from that point. So I like that from that regard. And basically saying, if you take a transfer from outside of that window that declared that they are unenrolling outside of that window. So if somebody's in the portal now and declared back when it was open, it's not a problem. It's just if somebody unenrolls tomorrow and decides they want to enroll somewhere else, that's when the penalty will hit. So I think if the emphasis on trying to solidify the rosters and sort of bring some kind of calm to some of these teams, I think it makes a lot of sense. And you add some teeth behind it, behind fines and suspensions and roster limits too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, losing up to 20% of your budget, that should be enough to scare away a lot of these programs, but we'll see. There will be lawyers.
Mike, that's the only people that are winning in college football's chaos right now. Lawyers.
All right, Stephen. Hey, so I think that's all we got on this episode. You got any final thoughts before we hang up here?
Mike, I think, excited to get to read some spring practice stuff. I don't know about you, but as all the basketball stuff and all the basketball tournaments are great. I will try to watch some NCAA tournament games this year, but I'm just fired up to check out some of these spring practice reports and see if we can make some sense of these teams, right? I mean, we went too long without football.
Yeah, and I think more than ever, it's difficult to get a read on a lot of these teams with the transfers, with the coaching transitions. So I really hope that spring serves to kind of shore up some of these uncertainties, because there's uncertainties across the board with a lot of these teams. So I'm certainly needing some help with what's going on with a lot of these teams. You know what?
Maybe spring games come back. You know, I know some of the schools are bringing it back, and maybe there's actually some good scrimmaging that we can take from that. So I don't know. I mean, between the new transfer policy for transfers outside the window, maybe some spring games coming back, it's not like old college football, but it is kind of nice to maybe have a little bit of clarity on some of these teams going into and out of spring practice. So I can't wait. I know it's practicing on air, but it's just nice to have college football back.
Yeah, without a doubt. Well, all right, Stephen, before we close, as always, can you remind the cousins how to follow you and how to find your work?
Absolutely. AthlonSports.com, daily college football writings and scribings up there. Mike, you can also follow me on Twitter at AthlonSteven, Stephen L. CFB over on Facebook and Instagram.
All right, so we appreciate each and every one of you for hanging out. We'll catch you tomorrow. Cousin Shane, I'll get his ass off the golf course. He'll be back. Until then, we'll catch you on the next one.
Hey, buddy, this beer's for you, Mike, and Cousin Shane. That SEC podcast loves the pirate, and the pirate loves that SEC podcast. Hail State.